Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:31 p.m. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, February 2nd. Happy Marmot Day, everyone. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. I would like everyone to please turn off or silence your cell phones and join with me in extending an especially warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Renzo Moises. Today, we have three items on our agenda. Senate Bill 170, Gaming Electronic Pull Tabs. Senate Bill 211, Extend Occupational Licensing Boards, followed up by Senate Bill 81, Public Employer Pension Contributions. First up today is Senate Bill 170. Today, it is my intention to bring a committee substitute before the committee for consideration. We'll have some committee discussion and look to the will of the committee. Is there any discussion on Senate Bill 170 before we consider the committee substitute? Hearing and seeing none at this time, may I members have a draft proposed committee substitute in their packet? May I have a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 170, version 34-LS0213/Oscar as the working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. My staff, the award-winning Conrad Jackson, is here to present the committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The CS before the members for consideration, version /O, has three small changes, the first being found in section 19 on page 8. And in this section, we're bringing parity to the door prize limits that you will see in section 20. Switch to that page very quickly here. Section 20, we made that adjustment in the prior CS. We doubled the current prize limits. Former prize limits in section 19 were higher than that. So we've brought them down into parity to $40,000 and monthly and $480,000 annually. The next change is on page 15, section 32. And we are amending AS 0515-180A2 by deleting references to payments by credits or credit vouchers and to electronically transferred funds for the purposes of purchasing an electronic pull tab. We further amend A3 and in doing so, we're adding a restriction that an electronic pull tab system may not be part of any system that accepts credit cards. The next change is on page 19, section 41, and we're amending AS 0515-188Q, and we're granting a vendor the authority to pay a distributor on behalf of a permittee. That is the extent of the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to this proposed committee substitute? Hearing none, the CS version /O, as in Ozinki, is before the members as a working document. Is there any further committee discussion on the underlying bill? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a brief comment before we move on about the bill, because there's a company that is in my district, and they serve as a distributor for pull tabs, and they may be negatively affected by the bill as it's currently written, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention, specifically in sections 25 and 26. But please know that I don't want to slow down the process by no means, but my hope is that this issue can be reexamined more closely as it travels through other committees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator. Is there any further discussion of this item? I would like to thank the committee for their time in working on this bill. It has been a very interesting process working with all of the stakeholders in trying to interpret everyone's self-interest and reminding manufacturers, distributors, and for-profit businesses that the reason why we have charitable gaming in this state is to allow nonprofits and charities to make money. And that is the reason for this program of paper pull tabs in the state now. And it is to that end, with that goal in mind, that I believe it's time to modernize pull tabs in the state of Alaska so that charities and nonprofits can continue to make money. Their profits and their ability to raise funds through pull tabs are being squeezed out right now because of the very high cost of printing paper tickets. It's gone up by 5 to 6 times. That means much of their profits have evaporated due to that high cost. So electronic pull tabs would bring down that cost and restore charities, nonprofits, veteran service organizations' ability to raise money in an effective way for their groups. And also, the regulations that we put in place here are designed to ensure that one company who is for-profit cannot maximize their profits at the expense of charities, at the expense of the nonprofits who should be able to raise money without fear of monopolistic control or vertical price integration that would outcompete others and then drive up prices of the products needed by nonprofits to raise money through pull tabs. So I've tried my best to structure the bill in this way, and I'm excited to see it move through the process as it moves to the capable Senate Finance Committee next. So thank you all. If there's no further discussion, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 170, version 34-LS0213/Oscar, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? I'll object one more time just for the purpose to add that this bill will likely make the state money and be revenue positive, which in today's fiscal climate would be good. I'll remove my objection. Hearing no further objection, Senate Bill 170, version 34-LS0213/O, as an Oscar, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 1:41 now here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Next up is Senate Bill 211. This is our first hearing on this bill. With us to present the bill, we have one of my team members, Mr. Matt Churchill. Mr. Churchill, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please join us at the table. Thank you very much. State your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 211 today. For the record, Matt Churchill, and I'm staff to Senator Bjorkman. This bill would extend the sunset date of 5 state professional boards, those of professional counselors, marital and family therapy, psychologists and psychological examiners, social work examiners, and of the Real Estate Commission from their current sunset dates of June 30th of this year. Senate Bill 211 follows the extensions recommended by the state's audits for each of these boards. the state's audits recommended extending the boards of marital and family therapy and of social work examiners each by 8 years, and that's the maximum extension allowed by statute. The audits of the boards of professional counselors and certified real estate appraisers recommended 6-year extensions. The audit of the board of psychological and psychological examiners recommended a 5-year extension. And finally, the audit of the real estate commission recommended extending that board's termination date by 4 years. Chris Curtis, our legislative auditor, is here today to speak further to the committee regarding the details addressed in the state's audits. Mr. Chairman, I understand that the committee will be adopting a substitute later in this afternoon's meeting to include the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers in this bill. And Ms. Curtis plans to address this audit when that bill is taken up at the committee's next meeting on Wednesday, I believe. And then also at Wednesday's meeting, Director Sylvan Robb of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, as well as some of the chairs of the audited boards, will be available for testimony and answer any further questions by the committee. The remaining chairs of the 6 boards will be available as planned on Friday at that meeting. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 211.
Thank you, Mr. Churchill. Are there any committee questions? Hearing and seeing none, at this time, we will have our friendly neighborhood state legislative auditor, Ms. Chris Curtis, join us to speak about the audits that she and her staff have performed on these boards and the extension bills before us. Ms. Curtis, welcome again to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor, friendly state legislative auditor. There are 5 boards extended by SB 211, and I'll be going through the audit reports at very high level and fairly quickly, but if you have any questions, please let me know and I can stop and answer them. So starting off with the Real Estate Commission, overall we found this commission effectively conducted their meetings, they actively amended their regulations, and they effectively were licensing their real estate professionals. But we did find some areas for improvement and ultimately made 5 recommendations. We're recommending overall only a 4-year extension, which is half of the 8-year maximum. Walking you through the audit on page 10, you'll find the standard licensing statistics. As of January 2025, this board had 2,854 active licenses and 591 active registrants. Page 11, you'll find the schedule of revenues and expenditures. As of January 2025, there was a surplus for this board of approximately $807,000. So now moving into the recommendations, starting on page 17, we recommend the DCBPL's director provide training and update written procedures to ensure minutes are prepared for all commission meetings. We found the subcommittee meetings were not having minutes prepared. In Rec 2, on the next page, the commission chair should update regulations and forms to include independent contractors. The audit found that the real estate industry is moving away from employees, and most licensees are independent contractors affiliated with brokerages. The statutes were updated in 1998 to reflect this new relationship, and the commission did not update its regulations and its forms. So all the forms refer to employees as opposed to independent contractors. Rec 3, the commissioner should work with policymakers to improve the recruitment and retention of investigators. And the DCBPL, the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing Management, should consider ways to assist the commission with addressing its investigative backlog. So we tested 14 cases that have been open for over 180 days, and all 14 had unjustified periods of inactivity. Those periods ranged from 160 days to 726 days. Overall, the average delay over that group of audits or investigations was 14 months. There was a lot of reasons for the delay. Some of it had to do with finding a member of the commission to review a case. Next, it had to do with commission members taking an inordinate amount of time to get the review finished. And other delays had to do with staffing issues like turnover and vacancies. We also noted that from July of 2024 to January 2025, the backlog of investigated cases had doubled. So the commission needs to find ways to encourage timely resolution of their investigations. And then Rec 4 on page 19, the commission should consider seeking legislation to eliminate the Real Estate Recovery Fund. This Real Estate Recovery Fund was created decades ago to provide a remedy for losses suffered as a result of fraud intentional tort, deceit, and et cetera. But in 2018, a law was passed that required licensees to obtain errors and omissions insurance. And since the effective date of that legislation through January of 2025, the fund has paid out only around $50,000 in claims, but it has collected $640,000 from its licensees for the real estate recovery fund fee. During our audit period, which spanned 3.5 years, there was virtually no claims paid out of the fund. So in other words, the fund has outlived its usefulness and we believe should be eliminated. And Rec 5, the commission should require all renewal applicants to submit certificates of errors and omissions insurance, which is a statutory requirement. Response to the audit begins on page 31 with all parties of management, the commissioner, the board chair, concurring with the report conclusions. If there's no questions, I can move on to Board of Social Work Examiners.
Any questions from the committee? I have a couple.
Okay.
Is the real estate recovery fund, is that a sweepable account?
Through the chair, no, it wouldn't be sweepable if the funds were supposed to be used for a certain purpose.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Please continue.
Okay, moving on to the Board of Social Work Examiners. This board served the public's interest by generally conducting their meetings in an effective manner, by actively amending regulations. Also, we found licenses were issued in compliance with state law, except for those that were issued as a result of the online applicant portal, and those applications lacked certain documentation. We also found one board position had been vacant for an extended period, so we're recommending an extension of 8 years. On page 6, you'll find the board's schedule of licensing activity. As of January 2025, the board had around 1,300 active licenses. Schedule of revenues and expenditures is on page 7, and we conclude that board fees were not set at a level that covered the cost of regulating the profession, but through general fund allocations, the board did not go into a deficit. We have two recommendations beginning on page 9. First, we recommend the Office of the Governor, Boards and Commissions Director, take steps to ensure the board seats are filled in a timely manner. And then page 10, we recommend the board chair and the DCBPL director work together to ensure renewal applications comply with continuing education requirements or seek a regulatory change if necessary. We found that the online portal for renewing licenses, to submitting your applications to renew licenses, was not collecting all the information that was needed for continuing education. So they standardized the portal, so all boards use it, but this particular board has more detailed regulations for collecting certain information about continuing education. So either they change the regulation or they amend the online portal. Management's response to the audit begins on page 21. Generally, Office of the Governor and DCCED Commissioner concurred with the recommendations. The board chair also concurred and stated that the board vacancies have led to delays in processing applications, canceled meetings due to lack of quorum, and to delays in closing out investigations. So board vacancies are negatively impacting board operations. And that's it for the Board of Social Work Examiners.
Any questions? Please continue, ma'am.
Right, moving on to the Board of Professional Counselors. This board generally conducted its meetings in an effective manner. It actively amended its regulations and effectively licensed professional counselors. The audit also concluded that one board position had been vacant for an extended period, and licensing fees were not set at a level that covered the cost of regulating the profession. We're recommending a 6-year extension. If you turn to page 5, you'll see the standard licensing statistics. As of January 2025, this board had 1,676 active licenses. On page 6 and 7 of the audit, we conclude that the license fees were not sufficient to cover the cost of regulating the profession. Now, according to DCBPL management, a fee analysis was conducted that supported increasing fees. But ultimately, the fees were not increased due to noncompliance with a new fee-setting process. If you turn to page 19 of the audit, you'll see a memo from the governor's chief of staff. And the memo subject line reads, "No tax fee revenue increases without chief of staff approval." Via this memo, the governor's chief of staff declared that new and increased taxes, fees, and revenues, or any other mechanism to collect new or additional revenues, must be approved by a chief of staff with input from OMB. So after this memo was released, Office of Management and Budget produced new procedures whereby if a department wanted to request a fee increase, they were to submit their request to the Division of Admin Services, who would then forward the request to OMB, who would then review the request and determine whether it should forward it on to the governor's chief of staff for approval. DCBPL management for this board did submit their request to the Division of Admin Services, but due to staff turnover, the increased request was not forwarded to OMB. This board had a deficit as of January 2025 of $210,000, and we expect the deficit to grow.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you don't have this citation off the top of your head, it's fine, perhaps afterwards. I'm wondering what the authorizing statute is that permits boards to set their fees or recommend their fees. And I'm wondering, you know, where in our statute does it say that that presumably independent process has to all go to the chief of staff of the governor? I doubt that's in our statute. And so I'd like to have that citation and figure out, you know, what latitude the executive agencies actually have to set their fees versus what they are directed by the law to do. I doubt that the chief of staff of the governor is named in the statute.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Alaska Statute 0801065 requires the department to adopt regulations that establish the amount and manner of payment of application, examination, license, investigation, registration, and other fees as appropriate. And then it goes on to say that it has to cover the cost of regulating the profession. We believe that these fee increases are statutorily mandated, and then by adding two additional levels of approval to the process would, at a minimum, delay the approval of the fee increase, which would increase the deficits, which in a sense is pushing the cost to future licensees. And the worst case scenario would be the agency coming to the legislature to ask for general funds to cover the budget deficits of their boards.
Follow up.
Senator Dunbar.
So in a case like this, and maybe this is a question for the Department of Law, but what recourse does the legislature have? So the law you just described lays out the process. It's mandated so it can cover the costs of these boards and commissions. But now the executive agency, or I should say the governor's office, is not following the law. What recourse do we have?
Through the chair, I think that's a question for legislative legal.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Senator Yount.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Are fee deficits typical? And what can be, I mean, how long has that been happening or lasting, right? And how bad has it gotten? So.
Through the chair, looking at this for many, many, many years, it was common, I would say, 10, 15, 20 years ago, administrations really were, it was hard for them to increase fees and have those negative impacts to their licensees and their constituents. This administration, when it started 8 years ago, took a real hard line, and the fee analyses were really strong, and fee increases in accordance with statute were passed on to the licensees as appropriate. It's just recently that we're seeing some of these deficits pop up. I would say, in general, this administration has done a really good job making sure that the boards are paying for their cost of regulation, and they've even been padding it a bit to help the boards from doing the wild swings, because setting the fee at a cost of regulating the profession, if you have a lot of investigative costs, that can result in really wide swings in your fees, which no one likes. So they've really been conscious of making sure there's a little bit extra, making sure that their fees are covering at least 1 year, extra year of expenses to smooth the fee setting process. We're just seeing this recently in this cycle, having the deficits.
Okay, so then a follow-up. then in your opinion, this board isn't in trouble fiscally right now. It's just this is currently they have a fee deficit, but they're not, you know, they're not in negative territory.
Through the chair, they are in negative territory. They're negative $210,000. And eventually their fees will be increased, and it'll be pretty shocking. And the increase will be much more as the bigger the deficit grows. So it's not doing their licensees any good by letting their deficits grow and then having to jack up their fees.
Senator Yount.
Can we, like, should we not be trying to get that done sooner than later? And what do you think a reasonable timeline is? Like, I mean, the real estate commission is sitting on an extra $600,000, right, give or take, and these guys are upside down by almost $250,000. Like, when can we fix that?
Through the chair, I think that's a great question for the department.
Could you possibly talk to them about that and bring that back to
through
us?
Through the chair, yes. In fact, the license go through a two-year cycle.
Okay.
So if you miss increasing the rate, you're going to wait 2 more years. And I'm assuming they're going to be coming up for a license increase very, very soon here. And I'm sure the department can address that.
Okay. Follow up, last one.
Senator Yount.
Thank you, sir. So just help me understand then why we're asking for a six-year extension on this one and only a four-year on the real estate commission. What determines that?
Through the chair. It's very subjective, and it comes right from me.
Obviously.
So I'll never recommend a full extension for someone who has a deficit. But if that's the only serious issue a board has, it's around about 6 years. Now, the Real Estate Commission had some other issues that we'd like to monitor compliance for corrective action.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anything further on the Board of Professional Counselors? Hearing and seeing none. Please continue.
Moving on to Board of Marital and Family Therapy. This board conducted their meetings in an effective manner. They amended their their regulations as needed, and they generally licensed marital and family therapists in compliance with state law. The audit also found that the public board member seat had been vacant for 32 months as of March 2025. We're recommending the legislature extend this board 8 years. Page 5 of the audit, you'll find the board's schedule of licensing activity. January 2025, the board had 116 active licenses. Schedule of revenues and expenditures is on page 7. As of January 2025, the board had a surplus of $196,000. We have two recommendations, one going to the Office of the Governor, Boards and Commissions Director, and that's to work with the board to identify interested applicants to fill board seats in a timely manner. And the Rec 2, we recommend the board ensure the renewal license application is sufficient to monitor compliance with teletherapy continuing education requirements. And those are new requirements that only apply to licensees that are operating remotely, but the board has no way to identify which of those licensees are operating remotely. And so they have no way of monitoring compliance with the continuing education requirements. Management's response to the audit begins on page 19. All parties of the management concur with the conclusions and recommendations. That's the end of marital and family therapy.
Any questions or comments?
Okay, moving on to the last of the audits is the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. This board conducted meetings in an effective manner. They actively amended their regulations, and they generally issued new licenses in compliance with state law. They also found some areas for improvement, which led to 5 recommendations. On page 6, you'll find the schedule of revenues and schedule of licensing activity. January 2025, the board had 371 active licenses. On page 7, we explained that the board fees were not sufficient to cover the cost of operations. DCBPL did a fee analysis that supported a fee increase, but decided not to forward that fee request to their Division of Admin Services, which is the new procedure, because they believed there would be a backlog, and they wanted to prioritize other fee types, like new license types, and get those in. So as a consequence, fees were not increased. The board had a deficit of $90,000 as of January 2025, and we expect that deficit to grow. We have 5 findings and recommendations, which begin on page 11. First, we recommend the governor's boards and commissions director work with the board to identify interested applicants to fill board seats in a timely manner and take steps to ensure qualified applicants are appointed in a timely manner. Rec 2, on page 13, the board chair and DCBPL's director should work together to ensure renewal applicants comply with continuing education requirements or change regulations as necessary. And this, again, is the online portal that is standardized and does not collect certain information that is required by their regulations. Rec 3, on page 14, board members should review investigative cases in a timely manner. So we found two cases that have been open for over 1,000 days, and we looked at those two. One of them had an unjustified period of inactivity of 656 days, and that was due to a board member not reviewing the case in a timely manner and a lack of other qualified board members that could take over the case. Rec 4, DCBPL's director should ensure courtesy licensees comply with monthly reporting requirements. This is the third sunset cycle that we had that finding. And then Rec 5, DCBPL's director should ensure the board fees cover the cost of regulating the profession. And the management's response begin on page 27, and all parties to the management concur with the report conclusions and recommendations.
Thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. Any questions from committee members? None from me, thanks. I did have one question that I remembered about the realtor board.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation that you had regarding a change from realtor appraisers from employees to independent contractors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did that raise any concerns with workers' comp? Are there any issues surrounding workers' comp where they have changed from one designation to the next? Did you discover any of those issues in your audit?
Chair, no, we did not. We did not encounter any issues with workers' comp. The individuals have been independent contractors for many, many years. It's just the confusion in filling out their application for licensure or renewal that talks about employment relationships, and those two entities are subject to much different laws, employment laws.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be important to eliminate that confusion. And we never heard anything about workers' comp.
Okay.
Process.
Yeah, thank you. And just for clarity, because I know we're going to deal with appraisers lately, but this was having to do with the real estate commission.
Yes.
And not real estate appraisers.
Right.
Which we'll talk about later.
Yep.
So, okay. All right. Thank you very much. Senator Yunt.
Yeah, through the chair, I'm sorry I missed this. This last board, the psychologist, how many years were you recommending?
Through the chair, we're recommending a 5-year extension for board of psychologists.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again for the record. I really appreciate our auditor, and not just extending boards and commissions the full 8 years when there are findings and there are recommendations, because actually this allows the auditor the opportunity to revisit a board and commission to see if they followed up on the recommendations. So I really appreciate our auditor's extension timelines. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. We do have some time if the committee would like to hear from Director of the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, Rob. Are you prepared today?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Great. Let's do it. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation on these audits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And I apologize, I don't necessarily have my notes in the same order that Ms. Curtis went through them, but I will try to stick with her order. So starting with the Real Estate Commission, as mentioned, there were 5 findings for this. Several of them are either directed to the commission itself, to some decisions that they need to make, the recommendation regarding having the real estate recovery fund. As noted, that is in statute and so would require a statutory change. The authority over those statutes belongs to the commission, and so it's an item that the commission has been considering. But it's certainly on our radar that with the change in statute many years ago creating the need for errors and omissions insurance, that the need for the real estate recovery fund is not as pressing as it was before the insurance was a requirement. And we fully concur that the commission should require license renewals for people to submit that proof of having that insurance. That is an issue that's been resolved since we got the audit findings, so that has been taken care of. We are working to recruit. We're always working to recruit investigators. I am happy to report our investigative unit has 26 PCNs in it. We currently only have one investigator position that's vacant, so we're having good luck recruiting and retaining members. That position that's vacant, we just had someone retire. So we are seeing our efforts at ensuring that the division is a good place to work and that is somewhere where people can see a career ladder for themselves and that they see a way forward, that is the environment we've created so that staff want to stick around, because there's a fairly steep learning curve and we invest a fair amount into ensuring that our investigators are well trained. So we want to make sure we hang on to those folks. I think next, Ms. Curtis reviewed the social work examiners. I think nearly all of the audits that Ms. Curtis reviewed, one of the findings is that we need to make sure that the board seats are filled. We know that boards and commissions works hard to find suitable applicants for those seats. We do what we can to help them with social media posts that the department puts out. I'm trying to reach out to industry associations and others to encourage folks who might be interested to apply for board seats. And again, on a number of the mental health board, the findings were related to renewals. Many of those renewal issues were related to telework. Obviously, telework is something that's relatively new. That's really blossomed since the pandemic. And so all of those findings related to renewals and making sure that we have either the documentation we need about continuing education or whether people are conducting therapy via telework, all of those are included and have been resolved. So we have a great team who works on our mental health programs, and we really appreciate legislative audit highlighting those deficiencies for us, and we got those resolved probably in less than a month. So updated forms and everything, all good. So we look forward to the next audit.
Very well.
I don't really feel like I need to go through all of these point by point, Mr. Chair, but I'm happy to, if you would like. There's enough findings. Happy to answer any questions. It sounded like there may have been a few from committee members. Sort of hold over.
Any questions? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Robb. So there was a discussion about some of the recommended fee increases not being able to get through the administrative process, and the administrative process being different or perhaps more stringent than what is recommended, or I'm sorry, what is laid out in our statute. Do you have any comment on that or the likelihood of those fee increases going through soon, so to prevent, you know, a catastrophically large fee increase in the future?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, we do have so statute requires that all of our fees be set in regulation. So once we receive that approval to increase those fees, then we need to do a regulations projects. And those fee increases are all in that process of becoming a regulation. And so as soon as they get there, then we'll be able to have those increased fees. As Ms. Curtis mentioned, we do try to keep a little bit of a cushion so that we can keep fees for professionals from being too volatile. We really don't want them to ping-pong all over. That makes it hard for people to plan for their business and just know what's coming. For the programs that are in deficit, we do anticipate that as soon as we're able to make that change to the fee, we'll see those programs coming out of deficit. We do try to take a slightly longer view and, you know, when we're recommending an increase, have a longer horizon so that we're not trying to clear that up in a couple years and have it be a big swing for people or a big hit. So we can flex things a little bit to cover as we're getting them out of deficit. So we keep track of all the books to make sure people are only paying for what they should pay for. But in terms of, you know, getting staff paid and paying the rent, we can do all that while still waiting for them to come out of deficit a little bit more gradually.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Indeed.
So Ms. Curtis had mentioned that these fee changes were being routed through the chief of staff of the governor's office. Is that true? Is that your understanding? And if so, is that permitted or laid out in statute that our regulatory changes have final approval with the chief of staff of the governor?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, that is not laid out specifically in our statutes. As Ms. Curtis mentioned, the statute that authorizes our fees is AS 0801065. It does not mention other members of the executive branch. But I wouldn't care to comment on what else might be hiding in the Executive Budget Act. So I will know my limits.
Thank you, Director. Further questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Yunt.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So you talk about paying payroll and keeping the lights on and different things. How do you do that when you're negative over $200,000, the professional counselor? So can you explain that just to a regular public person out there watching the meeting today? Like, how do they pay to keep that, you know, that board going when they're down over $200,000? Who's paying the bills?
Yeah, that's a great question. Through the chair to Senator Yunt. So the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing is just one allocation within the state budget, the entire division. So each of our boards or programs are not line items in the budget. So we, because of the statute I just mentioned, 0801065, that requires us to charge a license fee that is set to the cost of regulating that profession, we keep very close track of how much money is spent on each of those programs. That being said, you know, we operate as one unit, and so we can keep pay our bills with, you know, we know that other programs have a surplus. And so it's, everybody has the accounting of the funds that they need, but.
Okay. Follow up.
Senator Yunt.
I mean, to the average person, it may seem like the Real Estate Commission is paying the bills for the professional counselors. Right, right. One's up over $600,000. One's down over $200,000. That is, like, to me, just, I don't know. It's not working in my mind. Quick question: What is like the shortest term? We've got one here that's 4 years, one that's five, one that's six, and two that's eight. What would be the shortest time that you would extend one of these boards?
Through the chair to Senator Yunt. I just want to reassure the public that, Real Estate Commission licensees are not paying for professional counselors.
That's how it looks. But.
I can understand that, but we do.
Someone is paying. Somebody is paying. Not them, but yeah.
Yeah. Certainly, I feel like the question of the shortest extension is really a question for Ms. Curtis. I do know that it takes a period of time for them to conduct the audit, so. The shortest one I've seen is 2 years, but that's really a question for Ms. Curtis to answer.
Final question for, I think it'll be my final one.
Senator Yunt.
Will we see this SB 211 again in our committee one more time before it leaves? Okay. I'm good for today. Thank you.
Director Rob, could you please just expand on your answer a little bit about how the monies for these boards are accounted separately and how they're tracked to make sure that the licensees that each board regulates are responsible to pay
for the cost of regulation of their profession, please?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. And so I will hold this up, which will not be terribly helpful for the public. And this is obviously way too small to see. So this is the kind of accounting that we provide for each of our programs. So this lays out the expenditures and revenue for each program. So we literally have 45 spreadsheets that we're using to track the different programs to ensure that licensees are only paying for the costs associated with their program. So obviously we track their revenue and then we track expenses using cost accounting. So individuals, many staff only work on one program, so it's pretty easy. Like I work on the nurse licensure team, all I ever do is look at nursing applications. We have a number of smaller programs that have fewer than 100 licensees, and so obviously that doesn't keep someone busy full-time year-round. And so they work on different programs. And so they keep track in the same way that maybe an attorney or an accountant or other people who do billings to say, you know, I spent 2 hours today working on morticians, and then I spent 6 hours working on real estate appraisers to ensure that each of those programs is paying for the appropriate amount of time. So we track staff time in that way. We track investigator time based on it. We track time for staff who work on all of the programs. So our publication specialists who maintain the website and update forms, they track down to 15-minute increments, like which programs they're working on. And then we have allocation methodologies for all of the overhead that break the cost out relative to the size of the programs to ensure that each program is paying for its costs and nothing else.
Very well.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further on this item? Okay. Thank you very much. At this time, we'll set Senate Bill 211 aside for further. Oh, my apologies. I did forget a step. Thank you for reminding me, Madam Vice Chair. Appreciate that. So at this time, there is a draft proposed committee substitute in members' packets. Senator Merrick, may I have a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 211, version 34-LS, 1252/November as the working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Once again, here to present the changes in this committee substitute is Conrad Jackson. Mr. Jackson, welcome back. Could you please state your name for the record and present these changes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The CS before members for consideration /N makes just a couple of changes that were alluded to a number of times today during the hearing. First change is a title change on lines 4 and 5, where we are adding the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. Following that, new section 5 is inserted, which extends the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers from 2026 to 2032. And then we have a minor change to the retroactive date in the bill. The current bill has July 1st, 2026. The new CS changes that back to June 30th, 2026. Not much of a change, but a change nonetheless.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to this committee substitute? Hearing none, committee substitute /N is before the committee as a working document. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if we could hear again from Ms. Curtis just briefly.
We can. Ms. Curtis, welcome back. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Curtis, going off a question that Senator Yunt asked earlier, given I think several of us have concerns about the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, their deficit, and the administration's newfound policy. What is the, if we were to amend that number to 2027, for example, or 2028, if it's 2027, are you required to do another audit, or can we use the results of this audit in that decision next year? And if you are required, for whatever reason, to do an additional audit or an update, how long does that take?
Through the chair, statutes require that an audit be conducted the year before the term, the termination date. So I would have to do another audit. I do not encourage any termination dates that's less than 2 years because I have staff right now starting the audits already. We already have our audit, our employees staffed on projects. So you'd have to take a whole nother 2 years at a minimum. 2 years have been limited to those that have serious public safety concerns, like investigations that need to be dealt with. And we can't discuss the issues because it's a confidential investigation, or $1 million deficit one time. So it's very, very unusual to have such a short time. If committee members have big concerns and want follow-up, there is another way to do it. And they've put a requirement for legislative audit to follow up a finding in the uncodified law of a bill when it's passed. Mm-hmm. And then they require me to come back to the LB&A committee to provide a current status. So that's one way of holding your finger on an agency or commission to make sure an audit finding is addressed without requiring a full audit.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Indeed.
Well, thank you. That's good information. And I don't think any of us believes that this board has those severe issues. However, it also sounds like there has now been a broader policy change in the governor's office, mm-hmm. that will impact presumably every other board going forward unless that is resolved. And so I would expect next year's series of audits to reveal a number of deficits if the governor's office is not approving the needed fee changes to cover the expense of the boards. So it's an interesting issue where, on the one hand, this particular board isn't a large challenge. Mm-hmm. But if every board has this problem next year, mm-hmm. then we've got a problem. So mm-hmm. what, I guess, would be your recommendation to us and how to address this challenge?
Through the chair, you make a really good point that this is not limited to these specific boards. This is 2 out of 5 that have a deficit and their fees were not increased in a timely manner. And it likely is impacting all the boards. I really don't have a solution as far as how to deal with it. I've seen letters written. I mean, to what extent you're going to impact the executive branch's decision to have 2 extra levels of approval to change a fee, I don't know. At the alleged legal question to what the separation of powers and to the degree to which the legislature can impact an executive branch duty.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes. And we'll go to Senator Young.
Just a very quick one. Getting again to Senator Yun's earlier questions, though, when there's deficits, it's backfilled through general funds, correct? So,
through the chair, in the past, the department has come to legislature and asked for appropriations. I can think of multiple ones. In addition, during COVID, there was general funds being allocated to boards every year to mitigate the financial impact because there was a fee freeze that was done to mitigate the financial impacts of the. But there have been in the past requests for, there was one allegation that they had a bad methodology of allocating indirect costs. So they fixed it, but it put a bunch of boards in deficit. There's been a lot of reasons over the years of why they had to come back. So that would be one of the, one of the things that could happen as a result of this. But more likely is that the future licensees will end up paying the costs of previous licensees when their fee is increased.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Yunt.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, future licensees or eventually just the general fund. I'm not saying this is going to happen or that I'm going to offer a friendly amendment, but what would happen if we just pulled one of these boards out and didn't extend it at all? Can you explain to us and the public what would happen in that case?
Sure, through the chair. The licensing and the operations would continue. They would be monitored by the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Now, the downside to not having a board is you do not have expertise of a profession making the regulations. These are unpaid volunteers providing their expertise, and it would increase... I'm just theorizing here, it would increase the need to contract for specific expertise when you're doing regulation projects and that type of thing. So, and if you did not license them this year, they do go into 1-year admin wind down period. So they do not disappear right away. They have a 1 year wind down.
And you know, by all means, it would increase the need for that. Like you said, it would also increase the need for someone to maybe allow the fees to come up, you know. I'm not going to make that amendment, especially not today, I don't think, but it's worrisome to me when I hear that we don't really hit the panic button until they're $1 million upside down. That just seems, very fiscally irresponsible. That's all.
The chair, one last comment. I don't believe the fee setting is impacted by the board itself. The board goes away. The fee process is not changed that existed before the board. So the division is the one that actually is responsible for setting the fees, not the board.
Very well. Thank you. I think it may be an excellent opportunity to maybe even have a joint hearing with this committee and the Community and Regional Affairs Committee with the department to talk about board process and talk about this conversation, because there has been quite a bit of talk of chloroforming some boards, and then we just have the department take on all of their responsibility. As you just heard from the auditor, that could have the opposite of the impact desired, because you would really it would be a terrific way to grow government and bureaucrats, but I certainly don't want to do that. We have all these professionals that are willing to do the work of investigating and creating regulation that makes sense for their profession, and those are the people doing the work and that are immediately affected by those regulations. And then to somehow give that work to bureaucrats and expect to get a better result is a fascinating solution to a problem that I wonder if it exists. So thank you for that. Okay. Is there any further? Where are we at? We already did that. I removed my objection to the CS. It is before the committee. Thank you. And at this time, we will set Senate Bill 211 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Back on the record, it is 2:31 now in Senate Labor and Commerce. Next up, we have Senate Bill 81. We first heard this bill last year. During those hearings, we heard a presentation of the bill. Today, it is my intention to hear a recap of the bill, take public testimony, and look to the will of the committee. With us today for a recap of this legislation, we have the Honorable Senator Bert Stedman and his staff, Margo Youngberg. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bert Stedman, Senator from District A, all the islands in Southeast, and the two communities of Yakutat and Hyder. I got about a page and a half here, space and a half, so it's not too painful. But it's a nice little brief recap, Mr. Chairman. For the past two decades, the unfunded liability has significantly impacted the finances of both non-state public employees retirement system employers and the state of Alaska. Senate Bill 81 advances the state's effort to reduce the unfunded liability by providing the Alaska Retirement Board with the flexibility needed to adjust the 22% contribution rate. With input from municipal employers, the Alaska Retirement Management Board would have the authority to increase or decrease rates to achieve the measurable reduction in the unfunded liability and stop deferring the cost that inevitably grow the liability into the future. And for those watching at home, this dates back about 20 years to the unfunded liability we're talking about that we've been carrying on the books. In 2006, the Alaska Retirement Board set the employer contribution rates at the full actuarial rate, which meant the ARM board would set a rate to pay all current contributions needed for that given year plus whatever's needed to retire the unfunded liability. But in 2008, as employer contribution rates surged and placed significant strain on municipalities and school districts, the legislature capped the public employees' retirement system employer contributions at 22% through Senate Bill 125. The state assumed responsibility for the difference between the cap and the actuarial required contribution, relieving local governments of the excessive financial burden. And the reason we did that is the rates were getting so excessive, we thought that we would be bankrupting some communities all around the state. So the state stepped in, capped it at 22% of payroll, and picked up the balance, which was significant from both perspectives. The state assisted payments of a municipality and other PERS employers remain entirely funded by the unrestricted general funds, and we all know what's going on there. It's getting tighter. And for those watching at home, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars here. We're not talking pocket change. In this current upcoming budget, this rate was expected to be about $270 million from the ARM board. The governor has put $232 million in the budget. That's 1 year. Those rates are forecasted to escalate year on year going forward. So we've got to definitely take a look at and get this thing under control. At the local level, a contribution cap represents 22% of the aggregate payroll. Approximately 9% of that amount goes towards the normal cost, the current year's benefit calculation for the active employees, while the remaining roughly 13% is applied to the unfunded liability. And that's the aggregate across the state. Each community is different. Each member's a little bit different depending on your balance of what tier you're in and stuff. But generally speaking, it's 13% of the aggregate payroll. So when you think of City Hall, you can take a look at their entire payroll, and 13% is this burden going to the unfunded liability that has to be funded through property tax or sales tax or some mechanism. Removing the 22% cap and bringing non-state PERS employers to the table to participate in the discussion of setting the rate would encourage both communities and the state to pay down the liability sooner rather than later and not try to shift the liability from one entity to the other. And the state has been very creative over the last 2 decades in shifting this more of this burden onto City Hall to the tune of probably pushing a couple billion bucks by just the way they change amortization and so on and so forth. So this bill would bring everybody at the table to have that discussion. Doesn't say they have to change the 22%, but says they could lower it or they could raise it. But I can assure you it will increase the participation rate in the discussion. Continuing these policies of the past 18 years has resulted in decades of payments toward exhausting the liability. The extension continued to burden our communities while also hindering the ability to potentially allocate the monies toward critical local priorities. And that priorities could be salary increases, you know, lower taxes, more money for their school functions, whatever the individual community wants to pay. So it is significant, Mr. Chairman, and when we look forward the next couple of years, and we're asking finance to get updated numbers on this, they're looking at ratcheting up these contribution dollar amounts into the future, we need to have the all members of the system at the table to discuss this and then set that rate. And ideally, it would be nice to extinguish this liability so it's not passed on to future generations. It's gone on for 20 years and forecasted to go on for another 20 years. That's 40 years. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that is in essence what this bill is. It's a sticky issue to talk about. No one likes to talk about this, especially the magnitude. We rarely talk about it in the budget process. We just fund it. But it's a couple hundred million dollars, and that's bigger than our capital budget. That's bigger than our school funding increases. I mean, it's bigger than a lot of things. And just for those watching at home, don't assume, because it would not be true, that there's any liquidity crisis within our retirement plan and there's any issues of non-payment. That is not the case at all. What we're talking about is the paying off the future unfunded liability. And it's guaranteed by the Constitution of the state of Alaska that we cannot diminish benefits. So nobody's going to miss any payments. No payments are going to be late. And in essence, Mr. Chairman, that's what this bill puts on the table.
Thank you very much, Senator Stedman. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if we had this conversation last year and I'm just not recalling. You mentioned this 22% cap, but unless I'm not seeing it here, there's no repealers in this bill. So where does that 22% cap live? Is it in regulation, not statute? Or how does this sort of obviate that cap and allow the on board to go outside it if there's no repealers in the bill?
I think, well, we put that in. And we would have to, my understanding is we'd have to repeal that, but we'd have to check on that. Because what we want to do is have the flexibility within it.
Senator Yunt.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Through the chair. So the couple things I just want to make sure that us here and everybody watching has a good understanding of. So this has been about 18 years that we've been paying this unfunded liability. And I think I've heard before that it could last until about 2039 or so, so maybe another, 13, 14 years, right? If we do what you're talking about here, would that give us the ability to pay it off sooner by making larger principal-reducing contributions to the problem? And if so, where would that money come from? Would that be the state participating at a higher level or local governments or,
It's going to take higher rates of return in the portfolio or more cash going in pretty much is the issue. So I'm not convinced that it's going to stop in 2039 at all, the way it looks to me. It's going to continue on. The discussion between the municipal or the non-state and the members of PERS and the state will be an ongoing discussion. We set that rate years ago at 22. We, the state, set it at 22%. And it's been there for a long time. We were hoping a decade ago that we'd be able to go under the 22% and see ratcheting it down. But the state changed some of the amortization and pushed some of this forward. So it's just a way of, I guess, giving it some flexibility.
Senator Yunt.
Do you know what percentage of that, you said we're spending over $200 million a year right now. Do you know what percentage of that is principal reducing and how much of that is interest?
That's a good question. I couldn't really tell you. Because they really don't break it down that way. It's like on a mortgage.
I wish they did, because it would simplify it. Well, Those are things that I suppose can be answered at the finance table too. Obviously, I assume that the next committee after this one would be finance. And so, but it would be nice to see, you know, if you start looking at the AM table, the amortization, how much we're chipping away at the problem right now and how much is just interest. And if we made an extra $50 million or $100 million contribution now, what would that do? How many years would that reduce? And so on and so forth. So thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, just for a quick note, back in 2015, fortunately, we can't really work with $100 million or $50 million in this situation because it goes into a bucket and disappears. We put $3 billion in. $3 billion. And that's goes kind of to your question. If you put a big chunk of money in, it does lower the amount owed, right, and lowers your payments. But if you continually stretch your payments out, you never catch up to it. And our liability back then was, the end of that year, was $6.5 billion. And it's around $7 billion is what I'd expect the report to come out this year.
Senator Young.
So you're saying in 2015 it was $6.5 billion, and what is it today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that number yet for FY26 because it or FY25, it's somewhere around with the combination somewhere around $7 billion, $6.5 billion. We'll find out.
Yeah, we heard that. We heard that number from the House Majority Leader when he presented last week. Yes.
All right. Well, I wish you well in this battle. Looking forward to it. I will follow it closer when it gets to Senate Finance.
Mr. Chairman, can I
have Senator
before Mr. Chairman, some good news. Before the year before the $3 billion, that includes, let me just say, before that it was about $8.3 billion. We threw in an extra. From 8.3, you threw in an extra $3 billion, and then we owed $6.5 billion, and we went down from there. These numbers are so big, the compounding is scary when it compounds against you.
Senator Young.
Last one. Whose idea was it to extend the amortization table? Who refinanced this and extended this out longer?
Senator,
what year was that?
Numerous times there's been discussion in methodology change by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. That board does that. They send their recommendations into the administration for inclusion in the budget. In this current year, FY27 we're working on, which starts the 1st of July, their recommendation is that we pay $270.2 million. That's $270 million. The budget on the table has $232 million in it. So they're recommending a higher contribution than the governor submitted in his budget, and then the legislature has not taken action yet because it's the beginning of the session. Last year it was 218, I think, 8.8 million. So it's these, and again, this is just for the unfunded liability. This isn't your ongoing benefit structure that people earn every year, right? This is the in arrears. So it is significant. Also, I'd like to mention, Mr. Chairman, that it's not really the discussion of this bill is dealing with health care. It is in surplus. But we can't use that money in the pension unless you want to go to jail.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I do not want to go to jail.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are there further questions for the bill sponsor?
One more follow-up. So,
Senator Gunt.
218 last year. Recommendation of $270.2 million this year. Only $232 in the governor's proposed budget. Is that just covering interest? Are we like chipping away at this, or is it just kicking the can down the road?
Mr. Chairman, I think there is some concern that the can's been kicked and getting pretty dented. I think the testimony I put on the table last year, which would be Now we'll have a new update this end of June. but we paid a couple million bucks or so, and we were in the same place we were 10 years ago. So when we look back in time, and this goes way back because I've been involved in this, unfortunately, for 20-some years, we thought the unfunded liability would cap out at about $8 billion, and we'd have it exhausted in 15 years or so, and the problem was in health care. Well, we solved health care. We've got a surplus in health care, and the pension, we've had the inability to get control of this thing. Control of it meaning get the unfunded liability down. But if the state did not step in to assist the communities, a lot of them would have went broke. And the first one that would have went down would have been Fairbanks. And at the time, we thought that Anchorage would have survived. But in retrospect, looking back, I don't think Anchorage would have survived. They would have went broke, too. So we're the last entity standing, the state of Alaska. We had to step in, which we did. But it's been an ongoing challenge, yes.
Thank you, Senator Sipman. Thank you. That was a bit of a walk down decades past in our state history. But Senator Yunt, I think you're correct as you kind of identified. Appropriations to past service costs are essentially making up for the gap in investment long term to pay for pension payments that the state will have to make years past or years to come is a gap, and you can call it whatever you call it, but there's bills we have to pay in the future, right? And so we have no danger of missing payments or missing bills, so oftentimes in a regime to appear to cut spending, what's been done even back in the 90s, and I believe this caused a big part of the problem with Tier 2, the retirement system, is that people shot to make payments into that plan that were at the very lowest end of the lowest estimate of what those employer contributions should be. And so, of course, you know, money now is pretty important, and then time value of money then compounds, as we've discussed here. And so we have a situation where we are at now. Once again, do we follow the recommendation of the ARM board to make a full contribution to meet their target date to pay off in 2039, or do we extend the amortization by short funding that so that it can be future politicians' problems? That's ultimately the question here. And the expedient answer has been in the past, well, we're just going to pay less now and let future Alaska worry about the rest, which is not, in my opinion, the right answer. Functionally, this bill, operationally, as the state can contribute more, local communities are capped at 22%. This bill functionally would include local communities in paying more to pay off the unfunded liability faster. Is that summary rather correct?
Mr. Chairman, if the ARM board decided that they wanted to do that cost shifting and make it 25% or some other number, they could do that, or they could make it 20% and push more burden onto the state. But I think we're going to have some lively conversations at the ARM board over getting this exhausted, because when I look at the committee, Mr. Chairman, I see some youth sitting here in front of me. And I date back 20 years, so the entrance of some of you into the workforce has been burdened by this your entire working career, if you were 25 and now 45. And when you're 65, I don't think it's going to be extinguished if we don't do something about it. So your entire working career is paying for benefits that were accrued in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. I think there's something wrong with that.
Thank you. The bill sponsor brought forward a slight change, as we have discovered here, a bit of a, I guess you call it a non sequitur. So may I have a motion, Madam Vice Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move the conceptual amendment number one, which deletes section one of the bill in its entirety, as found on page one, lines 5 through 12.
I'll object for purpose of the explanation. Senator Stedman?
I think we're dealing with the TERS issue.
Yes, sir.
Yes, the way this was written, the TERS is not, is a, The state assumed everything over the normal cost for teachers. Otherwise, we'd be just passing it on through the BSA and around. So the 22% doesn't really account, is not applicable to the TERS. The PERS is where it's concentrated, and that's an oversight in the bill. Because we're not going to have the school board start paying for the unfunded costs. That is the education is a responsibility of the state. That's why the state took the entire unfunded liability and didn't leave it at City Hall.
Thank you, Senator Stidman. I'll remove my objection to conceptual amendment number one. Is there further objection? Hearing no further objection, conceptual amendment number one passes. We will go now. Oh, we have a comment from Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to return to my earlier question here as we're amending this bill, if we're going to report it out. So I still don't quite understand. This bill expands the authority of the RM board, which makes good sense. But if the 22% cap still lives in our statute somewhere, how does the RM board go beyond that cap? But then I also looked in the supporting material. It says the cap was repealed in 2021, but I assume that was a cap on something else. So can you just help me understand a little bit more why we don't need to amend in any repealers?
Well, I think, through the chair, I think that earlier, I think I'll have to get back to you on the technicalities of it. That's all. Because if it needed an appealer, it would have been put in there by Ledge Legal. So I'll have to go in there and look at that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I guess the challenge is the intention is to move it out of committee today.
If we need additional questions to be answered, we can hold on to this bill.
I think, I'm not trying to slow down the bill intentionally. I assume that if there is an issue, you'll resolve it at finance. So I guess I don't require to do it here. We can speak offline. If that is an issue, it'll either be resolved at finance or certainly before it goes to the floor.
And I would bet that there are people waiting to testify under public testimony that can speak to your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions or comments? Okay. Hearing none. At this time, I will open public testimony. If each testifier could clearly state their name and affiliation, and we will hold testimony today to 3 minutes. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 81? Hearing and seeing no one wishing to testify to this item, we will go online to the Ketchikan LIO and go first to Sina Gubatayo. Ma'am, could you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Sina Gubatayo-Smith. I am the Assistant Borough Manager for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Regarding SB 81, the 22% cap was negotiated in 2008 under the PERS restructuring plan, which was intended to address the unfunded liability while giving municipalities a predictable cost share. Our borough has dutifully paid its share of the net pension liability ever since. Our community's current share of the PERS net pension liability is now over $57 million for the borough, the city of Ketchikan, and the school district. That's for a total community of about 13,500 people and whose population is declining. As far as the end of the amortization date, the original amortization period was set up at 25 years to end in 2030. In 2018, that date was extended to 2039, and there was huge discussion around that subject. In an April 29, 2025 presentation to the House Finance Committee, the Gallagher, I think they're an actuarial company, told the committee that the unfunded liability is not projected to reach full funding until 2048. So that's already a significant cost shift from the state to the various municipalities. Since 2016, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly has adopted multiple resolutions opposing any attempts to cost shift by increasing the PERS and TERS contribution limits. The Assembly reaffirmed that position as recently as December 1st, 2025, and I am now conveying to you the Assembly's opposition to increasing the PERS and TERS contribution limit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Gubitayo. I see no one new in the room wishing to testify, but if anyone in the room would like to testify, you can jump up at any time. Raise your hand, and we'll get you in line. We'll go next to Anita Foran. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Anita Foran. I'm the finance director for the city of Dillingham. I was standing in for Steve Carrier, who is our council member, and so since he is now present here, I'm going to hand the phone to him.
Very Hi, this well. Is Steve Carrier. This is Steven Carrier, City of Dillingham City Council. With the removal of the cap and the reduction of the ability for the state of Alaska to continue to assist us, over the last 7 years, we've had an average of $188,000 that has assisted the citizens of Dillingham. There's been years that it's been over $250,000, and it's a highly necessary funding source that we have, because, I mean, it absolutely benefits our community. Smaller communities like ours, I mean, we live and die on a dime, and that's one of the hardest things to have to fund for. I mean, what, you know, and having a predictable cost with a community of under 2,500 and declining, this would be a very hard reality to try to fiscally prepare for. So I would, as Dillingham, we would oppose the Senate Bill 21. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll go next to Donna Adderhold. Ms. Adderhold, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you. My name is Donna Adderhold, and I am commenting on SB 81 on behalf of the Homer City Council. And I really appreciated the presentation by Senator Stedman and really appreciated the discussion amongst the committee members. So thank you for that. The city of Homer is opposed to increasing the 22% employer contribution to PERS. We believe that the current contribution is fair and an increase would unfairly burden municipalities and other PERS employers, as you have heard from other municipalities. And, you know, we also feel, in addition to some of the other testimony, we feel that, you know, the municipalities kind of inherited this problem from the state, and continuing to increase the employer contribution is a cost shift from the state down to the municipalities. We recognize that this is a really serious problem, and it's one that needs to be dealt with. And municipalities, in any conversations about a change, municipalities and other employers need to have a seat at that table. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Adderhold. Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify to Senate Bill 81? Hearing and seeing none, at this time I'll close public testimony. We'll also take a brief at ease.
On the record, 3:02 p.m. Some additional questions and points of interest have arisen from committee members about Senate Bill 81, so we will not be looking to the will of the committee to move this bill out today. Instead, we will put some questions together in writing to the Department of Administration and likely the Arm Board as well about what their intentions are in the future and then what actually is possible and in force right now in statute that is driving some of the policy choices that are being made by the Arm Board as well as municipalities about what it is they are doing. So I think we'll leave it there for today and take this up at a future meeting. At this time, there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce today. Commerce Committee today. We will meet again on Wednesday when we will once again take up Senate Bill 211, our suite of board extension bills, and talk about other bills under bills previously heard. We are adjourned at 3:04 p.m.